On this resolution calling for actual assistance to South Korea, adopted at the meeting of June 27th, Egypt abstained from voting. Her reasons, given by her delegate, Mahmoud Fawzi Bey, were...
The conflict under consideration is, in fact, but a new phase of the serried divergence between the Western and the Eastern blocs. There are several cases of aggression on people and violations of the sovereignty and unity of the territory of states which are members of the United Nations. Such aggression and violations have been submitted to the United Nations, which did not take any action to put an end to them, as it does now in the case of Korea.
But the resolution was carried anyway, hmm?
It was. At the meeting on July 7th, the Assistant Secretary General in charge of Security Council Affairs, Mr. Zinchenko, read out promise after promise of help.
Communications received from member governments of the United Nations. United Kingdom. Letter dated 28 June from the Deputy Representative of the United Kingdom stating that in pursuance of the Security Council resolution, His Majesty's government has decided to place their naval forces in Japanese waters at the...
And communications of support were received from Uruguay, India, Canada, New Zealand, Brazil, Australia, 52 states in all, giving assurances of support. And later, Secretary General Trygve Lie dispatched the following communication to these member states.
I have been advised that the Unified Command, United States Government, USG, is in urgent need of additional effective assistance. I should be grateful, therefore, if your government would consider the possibility of such assistance, including combat forces, particularly ground forces.
What's this USG Mr. Lie talks about, this unified command?
USG simply means the United States government. The council passed a resolution requesting the United States to appoint a commander-in-chief to take charge of UN forces. And it was at the same meeting that the council authorized the UN commander, at his discretion, to fly the United Nations flag alongside the flags of the other member states. Sir Gladwin Jebb, the United Kingdom delegate, said...
This is indeed a novel proposal, Mr. President, and designed essentially to emphasize the unity of all those nations who are now banded together for a common purpose and to indicate that they are acting in accordance with a higher law than one which is merely dictated by narrow national interests.
Later, Mr. Warren Austin, the United States delegate, was handed the flag by Mr. Trygve Lie, the Secretary General of the United Nations. Mr. Austin said,
I was invited up to Secretary General Lee's office, and there he handed me the flag of the United Nations, the identical same flag which has seen battle and which was carried to Palestine by Count Bernadotte. Now, Trygve Lie says, I want you, through the United States, to transmit this flag from me to General MacArthur, in order that he may have this very flag, which is a historic one, during the Korean issue. And when the battle is over and peace has been arrived at, then he will return the flag to the United Nations headquarters, where it will rest, we hope, in peace.
You know, as I've listened to you go through the record of the Security Council, I kept thinking that it's sort of like a fire department that we've called on to put out a blaze here and there.
That's not a bad comparison.
But I was led to believe that the United Nations was going to make this world of ours fireproof, so fires wouldn't break out in the first place.
I wish we knew all the answers as to why the fires burn. But we do know some of them. Mind if I call on the UN Charter again?
Article 55. With a view to the creation of conditions of stability and well-being, which are necessary for peaceful and friendly relations among nations, based on respect for the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples, the United Nations shall promote higher standards of living, full employment, and conditions of economic and social progress and development.
People get pretty desperate when they're sick and oppressed and hungry. And don't forget that two-thirds of the world's people are not getting enough to eat.
I know, but how can we concentrate on improving that situation as long as we have to fight?
We can get ahead with a lot of it if we succeed in preventing conflict from spreading. And as a matter of fact, helping people constructively is one of the best ways of preventing large conflicts. That's why the UN has an Economic and Social Council, 18 members directing a campaign against the causes of war and unrest. Why, there's hardly a spot on Earth where the UN specialized agencies aren't at work right now, including the trouble spots. One of them is FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization. At the head of it is Norris E. Dodd, a one-time Oregon rancher. Recently, he brought back this picture of what Asia's farmer is up against.
Where most of the rice of the world is raised, it's all an operation of hand. He sets out a little plot of rice, then he transplants all of those plants, one plant at a time, by hand, backbreaking labor, cruel labor. Then he irrigates that and weeds it by hand. Then he cuts it with a sickle. My God, if you'd give him a size so he could stand up to cut it instead of kneeling over with a sickle to cut it on his hands and knees, you would bring him ahead many, many years.
I know, but to bridge the gap between the farmers who have and the farmers who haven't, that's an enormous job.
It is, and we haven't much time to lose. Let's turn to another problem that goes hand in hand with hunger, illness. It's a vicious circle. Says a doctor at work in the Pacific,
malaria is a tremendous setback to the economics of any place where malaria exists, because although the individual may not get sick enough to go to bed, he loses his ambition, is very easily tired, he can't do as much work. He allows his farm and his fields to go unattended, and as a result, he has a very poor or no crop at all.
Malaria, which hits 300 million each year, is public enemy number one of another UN agency, the World Health Organization. In the jungles of India, the swamplands of Turkey, health experts are out to get the malaria mosquito. Their weapons are spray guns, their ammunition, DDT.
Well, forgive me if I carry your figure of speech a little further. How are we doing in this battle? Too little and too late?
Well, their first target was Greece, where there were 2 million cases of malaria out of a population of 7 million. Listen to how this fight even took priority over the shooting war in Greece.
I have seen the malaria aeroplanes passing over the lines, and I have seen the malaria teams working in villages that had just been captured by one or other side indiscriminately, and they were never interfered with. After all, the people that were working in them were Greeks themselves. They were plainly recognized as people that were making life more comfortable for either side, and we had very little trouble in that direction. It was much more spectacular during real military operations, in which they would even declare truces so that they could have the spraying carried on, presumably because they could fight in greater comfort, I don't know.
Both sides.
Yes, both sides.
And when the spraying stopped, malaria was practically wiped out. Crops increased, and in some areas, farmers' incomes doubled. And we had the same results in other countries with other diseases. A cholera epidemic snuffed out in Egypt before it got started. Yellow fever arrested in Panama almost hours after 6 cases were spotted. The flag of the UN was in these battles, too.
That's very dramatic, but, you know, again, it all reminds me of the Security Council acting as a fire brigade, rushing to put the fire out. Has anything ever been done to prevent diseases from striking in the first place?
Well, there's a very interesting worldwide operation being carried out right now against tuberculosis. The World Health Organization has teamed up with UNICEF, that's the UN's Children's Fund, and together they've tested 27 million children and immunized 13 million using BCG, an anti-tuberculosis vaccination. Here's how it works.
This baby received BCG vaccination shortly after birth because of a possible exposure to tuberculosis. As you can see, the lesion on the arm, he received it on the...
Well, that's after being inoculated?
No, yes, here it is. Yes, on the left shoulder, it can hardly be seen. It looks like a simple vaccination lesion.
And he wants to make a statement. Yes, in his language, that means it's very good.
I think the parents can tell you that there is no pain or discomfort in any way associated with the BCG vaccination. He's here today just to be checked. He's already been checked by Dr. Ritwagen, and she's found him in excellent physical condition.
Well, he's a pretty good baby. He stopped crying already after getting that needle in his arm. How was that, Michael? All right? Did you like that? Huh?
That's compliment enough.
And is this all still going on?
Still going on and a lot more. The UN Economic and Social Council sends out economic missions to help countries recover. Workers have their International Labor Organization. Scientists, artists, and teachers have their UNESCO. Airmen have their International Civil Aviation Organization. Whether it's the World Bank or the Universal Postal Union, the United Nations has a hand in just about everyone's life. In fact, it has adopted a Declaration of Human Rights for every human being. This is the way the UN is making the world fireproof. We once asked FAO's Norris Dodd whether it was worth doing it all, and here's what he said.
Is it worth doing? If you're satisfied to live in armed camps, made necessary by a world torn by strife and discontent, a large part of which springs from empty bellies, then it isn't worth doing. If you want to live in a world reasonably well fed, clothed, and with decent shelter, advancing in education and prosperity, order and decency, then I think it's very much worth doing.
Look, I agree that it's worth it, of course, but it's a pretty tall order. It's hard enough to feed, clothe, and shelter people in the more advanced countries, and when you think of the less developed areas...
Well, if you do agree with Mr. Dodd, someone's got to look after them.
Does the UN do that, too?
Well, look, the best man to tell you about that is Dr. Ralph Bunch, director of the Trusteeship Division. Dr. Bunch, would you care to put in a word here?
Surely. You see, in the United Nations, we're trying to draw a pattern for peace. And we can only do that if we can assure the non-self-governing peoples of the world that their aspirations will be realized.
You mean aspirations towards self-government or independence?
Yes. Take Korea itself, for example. In the past, Korea has been what we call a non-self-governing territory, the object of imperialist rivalries and exploitation for a number of years. The significant fact is that since the United Nations has been in operation, many of the most crucial problems of peace have occurred in areas of this kind. Palestine, Indonesia, Indochina. The trouble situations, the threats to world peace, often originate in these areas.
Okay, but how is the UN trying to meet this problem?
Well, in the broad sense, it's trying to meet it by underwriting the future of these peoples, to give them assurance that in due course, their aspirations to manage their own affairs can be satisfied by orderly and peaceful methods.
How many people are there like that?
Well, in trust territories administered under the United Nations trusteeship system, some 17 millions. In colonial territories not under trusteeship, perhaps another 160 millions.
Well, that's a lot of people.
Yes, it is. But here's the most significant fact of all. 10 years ago, only 10 years ago, mind you, the total colonial population throughout the world was approximately 750 million. Now it's less than 200 million.
A drop of over 500 million in 10 years?
In 10 years. Now, doesn't that show up the great changes which are sweeping over the world today?
It certainly does.
The changes due, of course, to the emancipation of these vast areas. India, Pakistan, Burma, Indonesia, the Philippines, and the rest.
When you say the UN will try to underwrite the aspirations of these people, just what do you mean?
Simply this. We want to prove to these people that what colonial peoples in the past have obtained only by violence, they can now get by peaceful means and an orderly process of development.
And do they really believe that?
Well, their reaction to the United Nations so far has been most encouraging. We have sitting now as a principal organ of the United Nations a trusteeship council consisting of 12 nations, half of which are administering trust territories and half of which are not, so that both sides are equally represented. It's responsible for watching over the interests of the peoples of what are called the trust territories.
But who administers these territories?
Certain member states under United Nations supervision.
How do you know what kind of a job the administering country is doing?
Well, the council examines reports from each of these territories every year. Reports based on a comprehensive questionnaire. More than 250 questions. Every subject you could think of.
Well, that's swell as far as it goes, but what do people of the trust territories do if they don't like the kind of government they're getting?
Well, if anybody has a complaint, he makes it.
About anything?
About anything. He can send it, of course, through the administering powers, or he can write directly to the United Nations. And that's not all. Periodically, the United Nations sends visiting missions to the various trust territories. It has just sent one to West Africa and another to the Pacific. That gives petitioners the opportunity of presenting their complaints in person.
And do they take advantage of this opportunity?
I should say they do. Recently, in the short space of only a few weeks, one mission was handed almost 300 petitions, some of them by people who had traveled as much as 200 miles on foot or by bicycle. Some people came in Western-style clothes. Others were dressed in a loincloth. The important thing was that there in tropical Africa, people knew about the United Nations and were presenting their petitions to a United Nations visiting mission. Really, the flag of the United Nations means something to these people.
Thank you, Dr. Bunch. But, you know, I can't help feeling that all this is long-term stuff. I mean, what's the good of even discussing it when we've got a war on our hands in Korea, even if you do call it a police action or an enforcement action?
I think I'll let the answer to that one come from Mr. Trygve Lie, the Secretary General of the UN.
I've been asked what I think now about my memorandum of the 10 points for consideration in developing a 20-year United Nations peace program. Has the Korean crisis changed my position, and is there a contradiction between my position on Korea and my position on mediation by the United Nations? My answer to that question is definite. There is no change in my position, and there is no contradiction. As Secretary General, my job is to do all I can to uphold the Charter and to make the United Nations work as a force for peace. In Korea, there has plainly been a well-prepared armed attack by North Korean forces upon the Republic of Korea, which was established under United Nations auspices. That attack is being met, as it should be, by collective United Nations action to repel it and to restore peace in Korea. It is my duty as Secretary General, as it is the duty of the member governments, to do everything to bring this United Nations action for the restoration of peace in Korea to a successful conclusion. That is the main job to which I have been giving my time since the 25th of June. But that does not mean that I have abandoned or have any intention of abandoning my efforts for peace by negotiation, conciliation, and mediation. On the contrary, when the peace enforcement action of the United Nations has succeeded in Korea, the need for the United Nations in its conciliating and mediating role will be greater than ever.
You see, men are fighting and dying in Korea for more than a national cause. It's to restore peace in order that the United Nations, and that means all of us, can go ahead with the job we've touched on in this program. That's what the flag stands for. The UN flag that humanity raised before on the sands of Palestine, the valleys of Indonesia, and the mountains of Greece and Kashmir. And that United States General J. Lawton Collins now handed to General MacArthur in Tokyo.
General MacArthur, I have here a letter from Mr. Lewis Johnson, the Secretary of Defense, which he has asked me to deliver to you. I will read it. Dear General MacArthur, it is with pleasure that I forward to you the flag of the United Nations, which the Secretary General of the United Nations has presented for your use as Commander-in-Chief of the United Forces in Korea. The Secretary General expressed the wish that this flag be flown at your headquarters until peace is established. He hopes the flag will bring to the Commander-in-Chief of the United Forces success in the effort he has undertaken on behalf of the United Nations. And so I would like to present to you the flag of the United Nations.
I accept this flag from you, General Collins, with deep emotion. It symbolizes one of the greatest efforts man has ever made to free himself. The Far East Command will do its best to uphold this noblest of ideals. Thanks and appreciation.
Thank you, sir.
A ceremony was ended, but its meaning had just begun. After receiving the flag of the United Nations, General MacArthur spoke to Colonel Alfred Katzen, the personal representative in Korea of Secretary General Trygve Lie. After this conversation, Colonel Katzen spoke these words by shortwave, especially for this program.
General MacArthur asked me to convey to Secretary General Trygve Lie his confidence and assurance that the United Nations decision will be carried through to a successful and victorious conclusion. He said, no matter what the efforts, the end will be victory. Thus does the flag, which is a symbol of an organization built up for the maintenance of world peace, stand as a guardian for all civilized peoples. Tomorrow I shall again see the same symbol flying at the seat on Korean soil of the United Nations Commission for Korea.
The Security Council, having determined that the armed attack upon the Republic of Korea by forces from North Korea constitutes a breach of the peace, have recommended that members of the United Nations furnish such assistance to the Republic of Korea as may be necessary to repel the armed attack and to restore international peace and security in the area, authorizes the Unified Command at its discretion to use the United Nations flag in the course of operations against North Korean forces concurrently with the flags of the various nations participating.
You have been listening to Under One Flag, a transcribed feature broadcast presented by United Nations Radio in cooperation with the Mutual Network. Everett Sloan was the inquirer. The program was compiled and directed by Leonard Cottrell and produced by United Nations Radio.